It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll be talking with about an exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum showcasing African-American artists from around Wisconsin.
But first, we're talking to a WPR reporter about news out of Trempealeau County about frac sand mines. Even though Trempealeau has already approved 26 mine sites, the county board just passed a one-year moratorium on new frac sand mining operations.
The moratorium was passed by unanimous vote, with two members abstaining.
Here to talk about the story is Rich Kramer, WPR news reporter. He joins us from our Eau Claire studios. Rich, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So why is Trempealeau County placing this moratorium on frac sand mining now?
Well, the person that brought the resolution through the Board of Health there said that the mines weren't kind of playing by the rules. She said that there have been a lot of violations, and while they have some fairly strict ordinances on what mines can do, they really haven't addressed health enough. And this board supervisor, Sally Miller, said that her office had been getting something like 800 comments and complaints from residents who are worried about frac sand mining hurting their health.
Now, as I've heard it, this meeting has been described as contentious, and then the vote was unanimous. So what was going on there on Monday?
Well, there was some jabbing back and forth. There was three members that were obviously not in favor of a moratorium, and they seemed to be in favor of kind of a laissez-faire, economics and letting the companies do what they will, and they're in support of jobs as well. The people that are against the moratorium are worried that this will hurt economic development in the county. And then you've got the people on the other side that are against frac sand mining and are very, very concerned about impacts on their quality of life. So there was some jeering coming from frac sand opponents that were watching the meeting whenever anyone spoke against the moratorium. And there was some jabbing back and forth between supervisors.
So now there's this one-year moratorium, but 26 companies have already got permits to start their operations in Trempealeau County. What does it mean for them?
Nothing. The 26 permits that have been approved, the permit holders will not have to they can begin mining whenever they like. There's, according to the Land Conservation Department in Trempealeau County, on their website it shows that 11 companies are already in process or processing. From what I've heard on the ground, though, there's only actually three sand mines that are active, mines and processing centers. So anyone that's got a permit already to mine frac sand, they are unaffected.
Now, Minnesota mining companies apparently have been moving over to Wisconsin. Do you have a sense about whether a lot of these companies have come over from Minnesota?
Well, I've heard from a local attorney here in Eau Claire who really represents the frac sand industry. His name is John Bailing. He's told me that absolutely his office gets calls every day from companies that were looking to mine in Minnesota, but they are coming to Wisconsin because Minnesota has what he would call burdensome regulations and unreasonable requirements for companies to mine there.
Now, it seems as though health is at the crux of this moratorium, with a lot of people being concerned about health effects of frac sand mining. What exactly are they worried about?
Well, the main thing is dust. This silica sand has a kind of a binding, when you mine it, the silica sand itself is kind of round and a very hard substance, which is ideal for extracting oil and natural gas. But when you mine it, it creates crystalline silica dust. And this dust has been proven by the EPA and is actually regulated by OSHA within confined spaces. So indoors, this dust has been shown to cause silicosis and is also a carcinogen.
What is silicosis?
Silicosis, basically these little chunks of sand are so small that you breathe them, they get into the deep lungs, part of the lungs. It's small enough even that this sand or these particles can get into the bloodstream. So silicosis, it builds up in the sand chunks get in the lungs, and they're sharp, and they create scarring, and it gets so bad that eventually you die because you suffocate.
So the worry then is that these particles are in the air and people are breathing them in. It's not a closed environment. It's in the outdoors, but I guess it sounds like residents are concerned anyway.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And that's the because it's not a closed environment, that's where the science kind of falls short. People don't really know what in ambient outdoor situations. There's not a whole lot of science, there's none in Wisconsin, that show whether or not it has an impact on health. Some states like California and Texas do regulate silica dust to a certain size, the particulate matter like of 3 microns or more. But Wisconsin was petitioned, the DNR was petitioned by people that were concerned about this to study it and create a rule. And the DNR basically said, we can't use these other states' rules because we are a different state. We have different situations, different environmental situations, and the rules on hand are good enough. So the DNR has not acted yet.
So now what does the board plan to do with this one-year waiting period?
They are planning to use this as kind of a chance for them to catch their breath because they've been permitting a lot of mines. This will give them some time for the Board of Health and the Health Department to conduct studies to find out whether or not this ambient silica dust can cause lung damage. And also there's concerns about water quality, whether chemicals that the mines use to treat water that they use to wash the sand is going to leach into people's wells. This is going to be like a fact-finding mission during this year period. The Board of Health is tasked with creating a committee that will come up with studies and conduct them to find out whether or not frac sand mining is harmful for health.
Now, how challenging will it be for a single county to conduct scientific experiments like this when this is really a national issue that has been looked at the national level?
It has. It's going to be challenging. I mean, any kind of study costs money, and both sides are going to be very, very critical of whatever results come out. The industry says, you know, one thing, the opponents of frac sand mining say another, and this study is going to have to come out with proof that is undeniable from both sides.
Now, there's another twist to this story. The Trempealeau County Board supervisor is being accused of using his office to promote his business interests in the frac sand mining industry. Can mm-hmm. you tell us what's going on there?
Well, it was a charge of an ethics violation that was brought actually by the same woman who's been pushing for this moratorium. She basically accused one of the supervisors of dealing himself in to the sand business and using, like you said, his office to further his own interests. This person, this board supervisor, admitted that he does have some business interests with frac sand mining. He has worked with companies, but he has abstained. He says he claims he's abstained from all the votes, so therefore there's no misconduct. But this individual has pushed, supposedly, the board to try to allow frac sand companies to mine sand on public or county-owned land. So that's, I think, the crux of it.
Now, this has obviously been a hot-button issue in Wisconsin for quite a while now. Do you see other counties following suit and doing what Trempealeau's done?
There have been a number of counties that have already enacted moratoriums. They all do it a little bit different through different ways. In Trempealeau County, it was the Board of Health that has brought the moratorium and has pushed it. In other counties, it's been through different committees or just different processes. So there's been a number. Well, Clare County, Dunn County, Pepin County, I believe maybe Pierce County. Just a number of counties, towns, and villages and cities have enacted moratoriums in order to study the issue and just slow down the growth of this industry.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for filling us in.
Thank you.
That was Rich Kramer, WPR news reporter based in Eau Claire.
Coming up, we'll talk to a photographer about an exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum featuring African-American artists from Wisconsin. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Back when we first started our show, we spoke with artist Hank Willis Thomas about his work on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum for the 30 Americans exhibit, a display of 30 contemporary African-American artists.
That exhibit is also accompanied by the Wisconsin 30, which includes works from 30 African-American artists in Wisconsin.
Both of those shows will be wrapping on September 8th, but before they close, we're going to be speaking with one of the Wisconsin artists involved.
Joining us now is media artist Portia Cobb. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
So tell us about your work on display at the Wisconsin 30 exhibit. What can we look for?
It is a digital photograph. My work is in documentary. Generally, I work in video. I've kind of stepped out of the frame. I used digital photography to kind of map what I was shooting in video originally. But I was shooting in a place that was rural, that had sweeping landscapes, and I wanted to capture that. As I started to look at my photographs as kind of a chronicle or log, I found them to be very interesting, and it, for me, created a new body of work.
And why did you choose that scene?
I have an attachment to South Carolina. My mother is actually from there. I'm very interested in the Gullah Geechee culture. And I started looking at land and issues of ownership in land. And there's a phenomenon there called heirs' property, and there were issues around heirs' property. So originally I started to do a documentary about my family, how they acquired land in the 1870s, and to kind of follow the genealogy of land. When I got there, I found myself immersed in what was going on. And it, you know, so it sent me on a new journey, basically.
Yeah. Well, talk about how you opened up those conversations with your relatives to get that information and to start telling that story of your family's journey.
It's very difficult. I find that it's better for me now because I've spent a significant amount of time there. I did a one-year sabbatical there between 2009 and 10. So I had to gain the agency of being there. Even though I was there, they knew I had a connection. Relatives who are my mother's first cousins would sometimes tell me, you know, untruths about the land and also about paying taxes on the land. So I became a taxpayer. So I put in every year, and I try to get other family members to put in on our end because we were the family members in their eyes who left, who abandoned it. But the heir's property is kind of a covenant, and it seals the land as belonging to all of us. And sometimes it goes in, down a different path. If somebody, a developer, sends one of us a letter or somebody who's not attached or has no interest and offers them a little bit of money, it then buys out their share. So my documentary took sort of a different form when I became involved because I was in the frame, not behind the camera.
Yeah. Well, when it came to selecting what to, I guess, bring to the Wisconsin 30 exhibit, how did you decide what photograph you were going to submit?
I had been working on a series. I actually submitted I think they asked us for about 10 images, if not, maybe 5. But I had been working and printing my images one by one. I would sit and counsel with another artist, and we would look at the photograph and talk about the merit of the photograph. And I knew that it was telling a story, but I wanted it to convey something even to people who were outside the experience. I don't know if they individually do that. I think when they're shown in series that you start to see the documentary story come together. But of all of the photographs that I submitted, Booga's Boots is what I'm calling that one. It is a photograph of from the waist down of someone who's just stepped out of the creek. South Carolina and the Low Country, where I spend my time on Yonge's Island, people often go into the creek to harvest oysters or to crab and to shrimp. And so he's just stepped out, and I was interested in his boots because of the debris from the marsh, or what we call the pluff mud from the marsh was still on his boots. And so all the other images right now are of land. There are some activities that are taking place. that I also photographed that have subjects in them. But a lot of the photographs that I was focusing on was of land, so I submitted those. But Boogers Boots was the only different one, and they selected that one for the show.
Hmm. So art is a very subjective medium, and I'm wondering from your perspective, how do you ensure that someone sees what you want them to see when you put together a piece like that?
I think it's difficult, and I think that my task, and I think what I've kind of reinvented my genre as, it's a composite genre. And so I'm calling it ethno-folkloric because it is about the lore of place. Most of my work is about home and place. But what I'm feeling is that my connection to it gives me a certain inside point of view. Sometimes I have to tell the story to get them to really look at the photograph, you know. So I'm not sure where my photographic body of work is going to belong. It may have to become something that also may have to become something that has some kind of essay. Maybe it's essayic in that way to get people to really invest in looking at it. I think that there is more work like mine that is looking at the South and places that are disappearing, and I think that that's become its own sort of impulse in documentary photography right now.
Well, tell us about the larger project that your piece is a part of, the Wisconsin 30.
Oh, it's really a privilege. It's an honor and a privilege to have been selected. I think every artist in this show can name two or three other artists that they feel could have been in the show. But it definitely has brought us together, and some of us have exhibited before. One of my colleagues is in the show, and that's Iverson White. We both teach in the Department of Film at UW-Milwaukee. And there are a couple of alums in the show, and there's a graduate student in the show who has great experience. His name is Mutope Johnson. It was another person who was involved. If you go to the largest show, the 30 Americans, one of the voices that you hear as you wear the headphones it takes you through is a professor here whose name is Shalene Green, and she's in the art department. So we all belong to the school, the Peck School of the Arts. And there are younger artists in the show that I had not met, were not aware of, and I'm really impressed with some of the work that I'm seeing. There's a young man whose name is Christopher McIntyre, and he sees himself as sort of the glue to everybody. He sees himself as sort of a promoter. But the art of that, you know, like really relating to the artists on their level and being among us. I could name others. You know, I think that it's very diverse and disparate in some ways because many of the artists are from Milwaukee. A majority of them are from Milwaukee. So I'm kind of in the mix because I've lived in Milwaukee and I've taught here for 22 years. Mm. So I know that my work sort of looks outside of Milwaukee. So I think that that's sort of my difference in the group.
I see. Well, we previously spoke with Hank Willis Thomas about his work in the 30 Americans exhibit on this program. His work commented on how advertising affects the African-American experience. But does the Wisconsin 30 experience speak to the African-American experience specifically in Wisconsin, do you think?
I think that many of the representations are, but I think that our work is so diverse. We don't always address maybe the obvious. There's some really interesting imagery in here that maybe is coming from someone's experience of, being a trained artist or not being trained, you know. I think there are portraits in it, you know, that don't necessarily reflect what we know of the Black community, but of somebody's proximity to that experience. And there are certain images that do definitely call up what we know about Milwaukee. If you're looking at the Bronzeville, rejuvenation that's happening right now, this week, in our neighborhoods, you see those imagery. You see, like, someone looking back on the past of what Milwaukee was, and then you see imagery that's definitely called up that it's about the future. You know, people looking at the blight in certain neighborhoods and foreclosures that have been kind of, overbearing in some neighborhoods. As you drive through them, you don't see them on the beaten path, but then you go in. Artists here are seeing that, and they're representing whatever is coming out of that.
Well, Portia, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Portia Cobb is a media artist, and her work is on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum as part of the Wisconsin 30 exhibit. We posted her picture, Booga's Boots, on our Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about just what Chris Christie is doing right, according to our guest.
And we'll also talk to a journalist about her book on education in other countries and why America is so far behind on the international stage.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll take a closer look at Wisconsin food traditions that are being featured at an Appleton museum. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Wisconsin has a lot of unique food traditions, brats, frozen custard, brandy old fashions, just to name a few.
But have you ever wondered where these customs come from? Well, the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton spent lots of time researching some of the biggest food traditions in the Badger State. We'll talk about how food relates to who we are as a culture with the chief curator of this exhibit called Food, Who We Are, and What We Eat.
We want to hear your thoughts, too. What do you think is the most iconic food in Wisconsin, and why? What unique dish or cooking style do you think represents who we are here in Wisconsin, and what food tradition best represents your particular family? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Nick Hoffman joins us. He's the chief curator of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why did you decide to present this exhibit on food traditions in Wisconsin?
Well, we're obviously paying attention to a lot of pop history and what people are watching on television, and with things like the Food Network, the popularity of Anthony Bourdain, but also the really thriving success of our local farmers market and sort of diverse new food trends happening in the area, we thought it would be a good time to visit that topic for a little background and context on how we came to that, at least in the Fox Valley.
Now, Wisconsin has an especially rich food culture. How did you decide what to include?
Well, we had a series of meetings with some scholars who have really specialized in these topics, Teresa Allen, Jeff Lipiak, Ruth Olson, who I think people will recognize their names locally with doing food or environmental history or the history of Wisconsin. And meeting with them, we really kind of fleshed out a lot of the really big trends. We also asked the community for their input. We had a traveling kiosk that went from restaurant to restaurant in Outagamie County and asked people to contribute some of their favorite restaurants that maybe they went to as a kid or today. So we had a really strong community voice as well.
Did you ask the community as well what the question that I guess we're posing to you today, too, which is how does food relate to our identity as a community? Did you get any input on that?
Yeah. And actually, our exhibit, we always try to make our exhibits very interactive and allow visitors to post their ideas. And we have three questions in the exhibit. Two of them are about that specific question. We ask at the end what they consider to be their traditional meals. But we also ask, as far as traditional ethnic foods, what kind of recipes they're sharing in their families. Our third question we ask is about defining a supper club, which kind of veers from that topic. But we're getting all sorts of really, really interesting conversations on those areas where visitors can post their answers.
Well, can you tell us about some of the foods you're featuring?
Yeah, well, we've divided the exhibit up into several really big themes that identify the community. We have a section on people and landscape, which really looks at how the Fox River has helped shape the foods that we eat, and how immigration in the past and the present has also contributed to our really diverse menu in the Fox cities. So in that section in particular, we're talking about traditional Oneida foods like the Three Sisters of corns, beans, and squash, Yankees who arrived very early in the 1840s and brought foods like oysters and lobsters. You could get lobsters and oysters delivered to local restaurants by the Fox River already that early. But then we're also looking at supper clubs, the type of foods that they have, the Fox River and Lake Winnebago with our strong sturgeon spearing tradition, and of course, cheese and the dairy industry, bratwurst, all those stories weave their way into the exhibit.
Are there certain regionalisms, too? Like when you think about chili, for example, if you order chili anywhere else, there aren't going to be noodles on it. But if you go to Green Bay, you'll find pasta in your chili.
Yeah. We actually talk about regionalisms with Booyah, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with as a Green Bay trend. And it's really funny because we're very, very close to Green Bay, and this sort of a stew doesn't quite make it down to Appleton. And we trace it as sort of the borders of the Booyah line as being Van Abel's Supper Club in a small community called Hollandtown, a little bit east of Kaukauna. Occasionally you'll see Booyah fundraisers in Kaukauna and Appleton, but very rarely. So some people who have even been longstanding residents locally, unless they've heard about it on the news, have maybe never tasted it.
Wait, really?
Is Booyah the term for chili with noodles?
No. Booyah is like a stew.
Yeah,
I've never heard of it.
I'm from the Green Bay area, so this is you know, that's what we got served at the church picnic.
Sure. It's just fascinating that even within our local region that some regionalisms are so sharply defined to one very specific corner of our two counties.
I didn't know that, you know, and I think about, has it reached Pulaski, for example?
Yeah, you know, we didn't quite look into the Pulaski region.
Mm-hmm.
But, as far south as it dips into Outagamie County, it really seems to be maybe Kaukauna, and that's about it. It's really fascinating.
Interesting.
Nick, what about the fish boil? We've got Carol on Facebook who wrote about her favorite food tradition. She says it's unique, fun, and all in one pot, the fish
boil.
Oh,
absolutely. And we didn't really find a lot of fish boils locally, although certainly there's Native American traditions. We used the Flavor of Wisconsin, the most recent edition by Harva Hatchin and Therese Allen, to sort of shape a lot of the food history context. And she talks a little bit about fish boils as sort of an early Native American tradition. So certainly that was a traditional food at that time. Today we really don't see a lot of fish boils down here, but you go up, of course, to Green Bay and Door County, and that, again, is something that happens frequently. We do have, of course, a lot of fish fries locally, and we tell that story through the history of Blyer's Bar, which I think a lot of Fox City's residents would remember. That was actually the parents of Rocky Blyer, who was a famous football player with the Pittsburgh Steelers. But his family has Catholic traditions. After World War II, they opened up their tavern, and looking to sort of diversify their income at the tavern, they decided to slowly start offering meals, and eventually their fish fry was drawing 700 people on a Friday night.
That sounds like quite a wait.
Yeah, for sure. But it's still really popular. That particular bar doesn't exist anymore, but occasionally they use that recipe at local church picnics and fundraisers, and people come in droves still to taste that specific recipe.
Well, tell us how this exhibit at the History Museum at the Castle really it deploys all five senses. How are you making it more interactive for the visitor?
Yeah, well, we were really kind of struggling with that. Since this is a food exhibit, we need to have visitors experience it on many different levels because flavors, sounds, smells, they can all trigger different memories. And that's one of the strengths of the exhibit, is that even if you're not from the Fox Valley, these food traditions go all over Wisconsin and throughout the Midwest. So even if you don't know about the history of one of the businesses we highlight, there's just tons of memories that are flowing. And so we encountered this problem with our challenge to have senses in the exhibit by incorporating smell boxes. There are four boxes that blow out scents once they're button activated. Cheddar cheese, there's a smell called fish market, cabbage, and then brandy for brandy old fashioned. So that, of course, triggers conversations and memories. We have music throughout the exhibit. In our section on sturgeon spearing, we have a recording from a polka show out of Fond du Lac, the Jerry Schneider radio show. And a lot of the sturgeon spearers listen to that every single mid-February when they're on the lake. And so we recorded it with Jerry this year, so you can hear people calling in with their measurements for fish and those sort of things. We also have a taste throughout the exhibit. We have jelly belly candies in ice cream, root beer, and lemonade, so people can at least taste a little bit of the foods that we mention in the exhibit.
Well, and we'll learn more about the interactivity of these exhibits. I understand that there's also a video game that people can play, too. We'll talk about that after the break.
Sure.
We're talking with Nick Hoffman, and he is the chief curator of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton. We'll take your calls, too. What food tradition do you think is most representative of Wisconsin? What customs have your family embraced on their own? Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
I'm Veronica Rickert. Our discussion continues now with Nick Hoffman of the History Museum at the Castle. We're talking about the most iconic food traditions in Wisconsin. We've got some nominees for that title, including the Brandy Old Fashioned, the Fish Fry, the Fish Boil, something called
Booyah,
which I've never heard of. What's
Only
your
as
vote?
A positive expression.
Booyah.
Well, let us know what you think should be part of the exhibit. Maybe you want to know if something is part of the exhibit. 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Nick, before the break, we were talking about the interactivity of these exhibits, and one thing that is available is for people to do some virtual fish spearing. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, one of the goals of the exhibit, we wanted to always put people in interesting new perspectives, things that may be a little foreign to their daily lives. And locally, in mid-February, we're all well aware that spearfishing or sturgeon spearing is happening on Lake Winnebago, but very few people have been out in one of the shanties. And so we built a full-scale replica shanty inside the exhibit. It's been fully equipped by several spears who helped by lending some of their furnishings. But this part of the exhibit goes even further by using the latest in touchscreen technology. So you get to actually look down into a near full-sized sturgeon spearing viewfinder, and you'll see a large TV screen that's equipped with a frame around it that has that makes the television capable of being activated by touching it. And we actually have that screen on top of a huge acrylic window. And so people can take a spear and spear down on this acrylic screen, and it'll activate the television, which has fish going by, and you can actually try and spear a fish.
Wow.
And I understand that to really bring this to life, we might even get a ticket from the DNR?
Yes. You have to look through the viewfinder and try and gauge whether a large sturgeon, which is kind of obvious, goes by the screen, or something smaller like a lake perch or a catfish, which would be illegal to spear. It's really fun. We've had a lot of sturgeon spears come to see the exhibit, and they get very frustrated because, of course, they could wait in real life up to 8 years or even more before they see a sturgeon come through their viewfinder. And here they come through every couple minutes by the experience, so they get a kick out of that. But they say it's fairly realistic considering that it's a computer game.
Now, Nick, we haven't talked yet about the way different cultures and their food affects the Wisconsin's regional cuisine. What about the influx of Hmong immigrants? How has that affected food traditions in northeastern Wisconsin?
Sure. That's one of the things we really try to stress in the exhibit. On one hand, we're celebrating a lot of our very longstanding food traditions, but we also point out, especially in our section about restaurants, how these traditions sort of come and go and how new traditions are constantly being created. And actually, when we ask that question at the end of the exhibit, people are starting to put things like egg rolls into that list of the most iconic Wisconsin foods because things have changed a lot recently, and we've had so many great foods and sort of a sharing of cultures in the Fox Valley as immigration continues to shape what we eat. And we talk about Hmong immigration specifically through the story of Mai Vang. Mai Vang came to the Fox Cities in the 1990s, and she worked for a large food processor but wanted to help her children receive or achieve the American dream. And so she started a small farm market where she sold stuff, traditional Hmong stuff, chicken wings, and it was just wildly successful. So she now has a brick and mortar in downtown Appleton, and her children now have gone on to college because of this. But, you know, it was very, very gutsy of her that, to risk all of her savings to keep expanding her business. But, again, it's wildly successful. And one of the things we encourage people to do when they visit the exhibit is we have a brochure that we worked on with the Fox Wisconsin Heritage Parkway to go out and experience these restaurants and visit them and spend their money trying a lot of the foods that we talk about in the exhibit.
1-800-642-1234 is our phone number to join the conversation. We have Fred and Madison on the line. Hi, Fred.
Hi. My comment is I've lived in the Midwest. I was born here in 51, and I was born in Green Bay, and I've lived most of my life in Madison. Basically, America, especially the Midwest, doesn't make a big to-do about food. And the idea that there's a native cuisine or a kind of local culture, I think that's a fake notion. We accept the corporate kind of standard American cuisine, you know, mashed potatoes from the 1950s. And I would say that my favorite and my most memorable food was Campbell's tomato soup with saltine crackers in the 50s and 60s. And I think that's the most honest comment that I could make about Wisconsin food.
Well, that's great. And you know what? We really try to stress that throughout the exhibit, that really our local food traditions are immigrants continuing to add different layers to what we eat, and then a really nice thing of sharing these ideas and these recipes with people. And that's really made our community stronger. It's been a great way for people to learn about other cultures in the Fox Cities.
It's funny that when he says that I, one of the things that I eat, and my coworkers really make fun of me for this, is pasta, just plain old pasta with Campbell's tomato soup on top of it. It's just like all mixed together.
Sounds like that's the Green Bay girl coming out.
It's like a family thing. My family eats it, and I thought everybody did till I came to college. We have Liz in La Crosse next on the line. Hi, Liz.
Hi. I am originally from Minnesota, and I moved into La Crosse 23 years ago, and I was introduced to what's called a chicken queue. They use it here in La Crosse as a fundraiser, and basically you get a quarter to a half a chicken, a scoop of baked beans, a scoop of potato salad, and a dinner roll. And it's called a chicken queue.
Wow.
And I'm curious, is there any other place in Wisconsin that does that?
I've never heard of that. Have you, Nick?
I haven't. No, that's really fascinating. I haven't heard about that, at least in the Fox Cities. But, you know, it might be in other places in the United States. I mean, even Booyah appears all over the U.S. in a lot of different regional areas. Sometimes it's called Booyah directly. Sometimes it isn't. So that could be replicated elsewhere. But that's really, really sounds unique to La Crosse.
Now, we haven't talked much about the brandy old-fashioned. That shows up in your exhibit. And Karen on Facebook wanted to share her twist on that favorite. She says a brandy old-fashioned made with maple syrup. So that is her special trademark.
Well,
what do we know about the brandy old-fashioned?
Yeah, well, we've connected it locally to the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. The Corbell brothers really made a strong push at the World's Fair, and that's one of the connections that's been made broadly in Wisconsin about our affinity to brandy, is that so many Wisconsinites went down to the World's Fair and brought brandy back with them, that it sort of grew. But I would encourage people to read a wonderful book by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press called Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries, and they have a really nice study on brandy in there that includes a very early recipe. I want to say it's from the 1860s or maybe even earlier, that is very close to the brandy old-fashioned that would have been something that was available in Wisconsin.
Ah. Well, let's go next to Daniel in, I think it's pronounced Minong. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Up north, Norwegian cuisine, once staples are considered Christmas rituals, best eaten with no stop or plug. What about lutefisk, dried cod, and lefse?
The Norwegian staples, lutefisk. I don't know about dried cod, but lefse is another one.
Yeah, that's really great. Another wonderful immigrant tradition to Wisconsin. We didn't see it a lot in the Fox Cities, although I've noticed when people list traditional foods that they still celebrate with their families, there's a lot of Norwegian traditions that are making it into that visitor response section in the exhibit.
We have time for one last call. Carol in Madison. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Hi. I come from a Greek tradition, and my husband and I moved to northern Wisconsin, and we found that when we lived in southern Wisconsin, my Greek relatives made a dish called sarma, which was stuffed grape leaves. And when we moved north, it was the same stuffing, but they used cabbage, and they called those roly-polies. And I thought it was fascinating that they, both of these traditions, used whatever they had. My mother only used wild grape leaves. She said they were more tender, and that's what the traditional Greeks used. And you can even buy those canned in Greek stores now. I just thought it was interesting that the Germans grew cabbage, and they were a more northern climate, and so they did the same thing, and they used cabbage leaves, and then they covered it with sauerkraut, but same basic idea.
Yeah, that's interesting, Carol. My grandmother made roly-polies, and hers was just beef, which was wrapped up with bacon and carrots and onions in the middle, but same name. Yeah, you find a lot of that, right, Nick? Lots of overlap.
Yeah, lots of overlap, sharing of different recipes. That's very common. We see even today there's new twists being added to traditional Hmong foods. I mean, they're starting to Americanize. Mai's Deli now offers Vietnamese and Thai food. So, there's just a lot of sharing. That's a very continual piece of food history in the Fox Cities.
Well, Nick, in our last minute here, what do you hope visitors will take away from your exhibit?
Well, we hope that they learn a little bit about our community very broadly. It's an exhibit that looks at our local technology, our tradition of being one of the first water-powered cities in the United States for electricity, and just all these wonderful stories that kind of shape and can tell us a little bit about who we are as a community. And hopefully they see trends just changing throughout history. One of our last sections of the exhibit talks about trying to envision sort of where do we go from here. And so, again, we ask people to really think about that. We've had so many traditions just come and go throughout history. What are our next steps in our timeline of food and what we can purchase locally? So, there's this long tradition, and hopefully people see themselves as part of that.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Nick Hoffman. He's chief curator of the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton.
And you can post your favorite Wisconsin food on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up, we'll talk about news that ACT scores nationwide are the lowest that they've been in 5 years. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. The news is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.